Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments, historical what ifs.
It's great to be back. Today's topic is one that, I have to admit, has really captured my imagination. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and the personal computer was this magical box. The idea that the entire foundation of that magic, silicon, might not have been there, it just short-circuits my brain in the most fascinating way.
It really does. For me, as a storyteller, I'm always looking at the invisible architecture of our world. We call this the Silicon Age for a reason. It's the bedrock of modern society. The literal element that underpins our global economy, our communication, how we tell our stories. To imagine removing that foundational piece, it's like trying to imagine the Bronze Age without bronze.
Exactly. It's the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust. So the what if isn't that it doesn't exist, but what if, for some geological or chemical reason, it just wasn't as easy to purify, to turn into the hyper-pure wafers that built our world? What if it remained just sand?
And that is the incredible question we're going to tackle today. We're not just asking how we'd build a computer. We're asking, what would the 20th century have looked like if the digital revolution had to find a different path? What would you be holding in your hand right now instead of a smartphone?
It's a massive thought experiment. We're going to dive deep, constructing an alternate timeline where the engine of technology runs on a completely different fuel. The implications are staggering, and I promise you, the world we build will look very, very different from our own. It has to be germanium, right? It was the original material. The text even points out it has similar electronic properties. So, in this world, the pivot to silicon just doesn't happen. The entire industry, from its infancy, is built on a germanium foundation.
But that foundation is, well, it's shaky. The document highlights the critical flaw, the reason we abandoned it. Germanium oxide is unstable. It's not a good insulator. In fact, it's soluble in water.
Oh, wow. So think about that. Your earliest circuits, your transistors, they'd be incredibly sensitive to humidity. A damp day could literally change the electrical properties of your device.
Forget a damp day. What about just the ambient moisture in the air over time? It means the fundamental process of creating integrated circuits, which relies on that stable, insulating oxide layer that silicon forms so beautifully. That process is a nightmare.
So the entire focus of early semiconductor research isn't on making things smaller and faster, but on just making them work reliably. It's a battle against the environment itself. You'd need hermetically sealed components for almost everything.
Which means cost and size. The miniaturization that defined our 20th century slows to a crawl. The idea of a microprocessor with millions of transistors etched onto a tiny wafer. That might be a pipe dream.
Yeah, you're not getting a home computer in the 1980s. You're getting maybe a room-sized mainframe at a university that has to be kept in a specially dehumidified, temperature-controlled environment.
It remains in the realm of massive corporations, of the military. And even then, I wonder about other materials. The text mentions silicon carbide as a high-strength ceramic. It's also a semiconductor, a very robust one.
But it's incredibly hard to produce in a pure, crystalline form. So maybe technology bifurcates. You have this finicky, unreliable germanium-based tech for some applications, and then this incredibly expensive, difficult-to-manufacture silicon carbide for things that absolutely cannot fail. Think deep space probes or missile guidance systems.
That's a fascinating split. It creates two completely different tech trees. One is a constant struggle for basic stability, and the other is a monumental effort for ultimate performance. There's no middle ground. There's no affordable, reliable sweet spot where the personal computer could be born.
Exactly. And that changes everything. The democratization of information, the internet, social media, all of that is predicated on cheap, powerful, personal computing devices. If a computer remains a million-dollar piece of industrial hardware, the entire social fabric of the last 40 years looks completely different.
And it's not just the social fabric. It's the mythology of the last half century. The story of the two kids in a garage starting a revolution. That story can't happen. The materials are too expensive. The process is too complex. You can't build a germanium-based computer in your garage because you can't create a hermetically sealed clean room next to the family car.
There is no Apple. There's no Microsoft as we know it. The entire engine of innovation, that bottom-up, almost anarchic explosion of creativity that defined the late 70s and 80s, it just fizzles out. It never gets the spark because the flint is locked away in a corporate vault.
So where does that energy go? That human desire to build, to connect, to calculate, it doesn't just vanish. Does it get channeled into something else entirely? Do we see a second, much more sophisticated industrial revolution instead of a digital one?
Oh, now that is an interesting thought. You're talking about a world that leans into the mechanical, the analog. Instead of miniaturizing circuits, they perfect what? Gears? Fluidics? We had analog computers, proper ones in the 50s and 60s. They were complex, slide rule and dial contraptions that were brilliant at specific tasks, like modeling fluid dynamics.
Right. So maybe the path isn't digital at all. Maybe the pinnacle of computing in this alternate 1985 isn't a Macintosh on a desk, but an incredibly elegant, room-sized mechanical integrator at MIT that can predict the weather with stunning accuracy. A machine of brass and steel and oil whirring away.
A clockwork oracle. I love that. And it makes sense. All that engineering genius that, in our world, went into chip design and software architecture. In this world, it goes into material science for better alloys, into lubrication, into making these unbelievably complex physical machines run faster and more reliably.
But what are the limits there? I mean, a mechanical device has physical limitations. Friction, inertia, wear and tear. You can't run a gear at the speed of light, so you'd get incredible specialization, but not the universality of a digital computer.
But is that necessarily a bad thing? Think about it. Our world is dominated by these general-purpose machines that do everything pretty well. In their world, they'd have bespoke machines that do one thing perfectly. You wouldn't write an email on your weather predictor. You'd have, I don't know, an advanced pneumatic tube system for messages.
Huh, a pneumatic internet. You're literally sending physical data packets through tubes. The infrastructure cost would be astronomical, but it also changes the nature of communication. It's not instantaneous. It has a physical presence. You can't delete a message that's already flying across the country in a canister.
It makes information feel more consequential, more deliberate. You wouldn't send a meme through a pneumatic tube. The entire culture of communication would be slower, more thoughtful perhaps. There's no flame war when the reply takes 3 hours to arrive.
So, we have these two divergent paths. On one hand, the high-end, hermetically sealed, ridiculously expensive germanium computers for the military and a few megacorporations. And on the other, a renaissance of mechanical and analog engineering for everyone else. There's no crossover.
And that lack of a middle ground, that accessible, affordable digital tool, that's the real point of divergence. It means the very concept of data as this ethereal, easily duplicated thing never really takes hold for the average person. Data remains something physical, something you can hold, whether it's a punch card, a magnetic tape, or a whirring set of gears. It has weight.
And that is such a profound shift in human perception. The idea that a piece of information, a song, a book, a message, has mass. It takes up physical space. It can't be copied infinitely for free. It changes our entire relationship with knowledge.
It really does. It keeps knowledge tethered to the physical world. And you know, as we wrap this up, I find myself thinking, I'm not entirely sure it's a dystopia. We paint this picture of a slower, more deliberate world. And part of me, the part that's weary of the 24-hour news cycle and endless social media notifications, finds that strangely appealing.
Oh, I get that. I do. There's a certain romance to the clockwork oracle and the pneumatic tube. But my lingering concern, the question that's still rattling around in my head, is about scale. Does that deliberate, slower world ever truly connect on a global scale? Or does it lead to a more balkanized planet, where cultural exchange is so slow and expensive that we remain fundamentally separate?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think globalization still happens, but it looks more like the early 20th century than the early 21st. It's driven by steamships and telegraph cables, which, remember, would be the absolute pinnacle of long-distance communication, not by fiber optics. So you get a globalization of physical goods, of empires, but perhaps not a true globalization of instantaneous ideas.
So the world feels bigger, much bigger, and maybe more mysterious. We never got that flattening effect of the internet, where every corner of the globe is just a click away. Instead, distance remains a real, tangible barrier.
Exactly. And that's the final takeaway for me. It's not that humanity would be less innovative. The genius would still be there. But the direction of that genius would be completely different. It would be a world of magnificent, intricate, physical machines instead of invisible, silent, digital ones. A world built of brass and steel, not of sand.
It's a powerful reminder that the path we're on was never the only one possible. It was contingent on the unique, almost magical properties of a single, humble element. Change that one variable, and you don't just get a different computer. You get a different world.
A different world, indeed. Well, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on this journey into what might have been. We hope it's given you a new appreciation for the silent, silicon heart of the world you woke up in this morning. Join us next time for another historical what if. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity, it helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.